Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dry Dock episode 411. This week, the questions are taken from Guide 484 and 485. That's on the Farragut and A and B class destroyers. The second video on Britain's anti-slavery efforts with the West Africa Squadron covering the first half of the 1820s. The other Wednesday video on the US Navy and the battlecruiser and their on and again, off again relationship with that ship type. And then finally, the Friday video on the Dreadnought Arms Race, who had the biggest numbers in terms of ships, guns, and shells. B. Huang asks, prior to the Farragut class, the US Navy had some ideas of destroyer leader designs. What was their ideal warship for that role? In the run-up to the Farraguts being designed and built, the US Navy doesn't really seem to have settled on any particular preferred setup for its destroyer leaders. They would, of course, later on build some with twin 5-inch 38s, but the 5-inch 38 didn't really exist all that much prior to the Farraguts. And so the only real commonalities you get are large and fast. Everything else is up for grabs. So the torpedo armament, eventually, most of the later designs say they should have 12 torpedoes in 4 triple launchers, but then whether you have them all on the center line, whether you have them split 2 triple launchers each side, or whether you have 2 centerline launchers and 2 wing launchers, that's all up in the air, because some officers are saying, no, if we're going to have that many torpedo launchers, we want to be able to launch a massive single torpedo strike. Whereas other officers are saying, yeah, but they draw particularly on Jutland at this point. They say, well, at Jutland, sometimes British destroyer captains were launching a good number, if not all, of their torpedoes in a single attack. And then later on, they had few or no torpedoes left when actually a better attack opportunity presented itself. So the layout of the torpedoes is all over the place in terms of argumentation, but also the armament. So there are no less than 4 different guns in contention. You've got small 4-inch guns, which previous pre-World War I US destroyers had used. You had 5-inch 25s, the anti-aircraft short barrel gun. And those were in favour, not because they had particularly long range, but because they offered a bigger shell and therefore a bit more hitting power than the 4-inch guns at not really a huge difference in weight. Then you had the old 5-inch 51 calibre guns, the long barrel types that you found on secondary batteries of US standard battleships, which of course had considerably longer range, considerably more hitting power, but weighed a lot more. And some of the destroyer leader designs even had 4 6-inch guns and a handful of 5-inch 25s. And the 5-inch 25 and 4-inch options sometimes looked at twin mounts instead of singles on top of all of that. So number and gun caliber was completely all over the shop, because basically there was, again, this argument back and forth of shorter range, lighter shell and higher rate of fire, or heavier shell, longer range, more hitting power, but slower rate of fire. And when the 5-inch 38 came along, everyone just went, oh, that. And then everything kind of settles in for the Farraguts, and then obviously later the destroyer leaders that get designed as well. Antonius Pius asks, a question I've never thought of before. All deck-mounted torpedo launchers I've seen are single-stack, i.e. they have one horizontal row of however many torpedoes. There must be some very basic reason that eludes me, but why weren't there stacked launchers, like 2 rows of 4? And if there were, and I just missed the memo, what were the cons, since obviously most were single row? Well, there were a few actual stacked torpedo launchers and a few designs. The US actually investigated at one point a 5-on-5 stack for 10 torpedoes come from a single launcher, although they concluded that would weigh as much as a 5-inch 38 gun mounting, so they went away from that. But the one that made it into service in relatively large numbers is the one that's currently being zoomed in on, which was found on some V and W class destroyers of the Royal Navy. And as you can see, this is a triple launcher, but it's essentially a twin tube launcher with another single tube stacked on top and also partly in between the lower two. So they form a triangle. So this is about as close as you get to a widespread installation of a multi-stack torpedo launcher. The reason why it's not done is very partially weight, because, of course, torpedoes are somewhat heavy weapons, especially proportional to a destroyer, especially a destroyer of the time. So if you put torpedoes a level higher, even if it's only, you know, 21 to 30 inches higher, you are increasing issues with stability a little bit. That's not really the biggest issue, though. The two big issues are, one, tactical vulnerability. So if you had, say, gone with the US 5-on-5 stack, great, you've got 10 torpedo launchers. If anything goes wrong with that torpedo launcher, say the turntable freezes, it gets hit by enemy fire, anything at all, that's basically all your torpedoes out of action. Whereas if you have two quintuple launchers, something happens to one, you can still launch the other lot of torpedoes. So there's a certain redundancy involved. But there's also just weight, because torpedoes are not light weapons. The torpedo launchers themselves are relatively light compared to the torpedoes, but torpedoes heavy. So if you have 8-10 torpedoes all stacked up in one location, firstly, you've got to probably strengthen the hull and the deck plating in that area to support that additional weight. So that's going to add more weight in and of itself to the ship. Then you've got to take into account that the turntable and the motors driving it are all going to have to be considerably stronger, because they've got to rotate at least double the mass. And that's going to add even more weight to the ship. You're also going to have endless fun trying to access the lower set of torpedo launchers for maintenance. And you're going to be precariously high above the deck accessing the upper row. So it just involves so much additional weight issues outside of just the localized weight, all the stuff you have to strengthen and enhance to get it to be used, coupled with essentially then becoming a single point of failure. And you also have to slightly readjust the launch mechanisms, because, of course, a launch mechanism that will comfortably fire a torpedo out of the lower launchers into the sea will drop a torpedo from the higher launcher in at slightly too steep an angle. So you have to make them more powerful and make sure you don't mix up the charges, otherwise you'll end up ruining the lower sets of torpedoes. And it all gets very messy. So in the end, people just decided, for the sake of simplicity, we're going to have triple, quadruple, or quintuple launchers just all in a nice, neat row where it's easier to manage and access. Almirante Brown asks, why did the Marine Nationale build destroyers with three or four funnels in the 20s and 30s when other navies had already moved on to one or two funnel designs? How much weight could they have saved by using a two-funnel design, if it was even possible? For what the French were building, it wasn't really possible to lower the number of funnels unless you wanted some really big, flat, slab-sided, trunked ones, which would probably end up weighing more anyway. And the reason for that is simply that pretty much everyone else was building substantially smaller destroyers. So a lot of destroyers of the interwar period were aiming at around about a 35 knot top speed. However, a lot of interwar destroyers, certainly before the destroyer inflation of the Fubukis, were 1,300 to 1,500-ton ships with 30 to 40,000 shaft horsepower. The French, however, after a very brief period, had gotten their torpilleurs up to around about 2,500 tons, which is where they kind of stayed for a good chunk of the interwar period. So you had ships that outmassed most other destroyers by around 75 to 85%, depending on the exact ship. And they were still going about as fast and occasionally fractionally faster. That meant you needed monstrously more power. And indeed, that was the case. As I said, most destroyers of the time had 30 to 40,000 shaft horsepower. The Fubukis were a bit of an exception, being somewhat larger. They had 50,000. The French destroyers were easily clearing 60 to 65,000 shaft horsepower, and that meant more boilers, and more boilers means more funnels. And the only real reason you see the Le Fantasque and Mogadors drop to two funnels is partly they do start trunking funnels together a little bit, but also they're moving on to both more advanced boiler designs, and particularly with Mogadors, the four circulation boilers, which allows them to get more power out of fewer boilers. Joris Amalan asks, what's going on with the photos in the Farragut-class video around about the 2-minute mark? It looks like the result of some sort of aerial attack run, with the way the smoke trail extends well beyond the line of destroyers, but that also looks like a rather large amount of smoke to be laid with a small 20s and 30s era aircraft. This was actually a US tactic that they worked on quite extensively in the interwar period, obviously designed for fleet actions, and it utilised, well, you could utilise land-based aircraft or float planes, but it generally called for the utilisation of carrier aircraft, since they're the ones you're most likely to have with you at most times. And yeah, it looks like a lot of smoke, but you'd be surprised how much smoke you can generate with specific smoke-generating chemical formulas. And the general idea was that some dedicated aircraft from the carrier would lay these big smoke screens to obscure the enemy's vision, and then the destroyers, as you can see here, would advance through the smoke screen, so they would be shielded from detection until they emerge from the smoke screen, and then at that point they're close enough to unleash their torpedoes, and it's, you know, a very short amount of time for the enemy to react, and so on and so forth. And this wasn't the only type of vessel they actually practiced this with. There's both pictures and some film footage of Saratoga being similarly screened, and an entire Lexington-class carrier bursting through a carrier-laid smoke screen, and you know that's a carrier aircraft laid smoke screen because certainly in the film you actually see the aircraft doing it. And they also at one point even think that this might be an idea for torpedo bombers, so you would load up a scout bomber or scout bombers with smoke generators beforehand, send them ahead of the torpedo bombers. They would then lay these thick linear smoke screens across the front of the enemy fleet, or basically down whatever attack vector was going on, and then the torpedo bombers would fly low and slow behind that, popping out through the smoke screen at the last minute and dropping torpedoes, so they weren't subject to interception or long-range anti-aircraft fire. It turned out to be not such a brilliant plan because, one, it's very easy to get disoriented flying through the smoke screen, and two, the wind could just blow it away and put you in a non-optimal attack angle. But also, three, as much as you were surprising the enemy, you were also left scrambling as the torpedo bomber pilot to set up a specific attack run on a specific ship very, very quickly, because you couldn't see through the smokescreen either. BK Zhang asks, how much impact did the Fubukis have on the designs of other nations' destroyers? It's a bit mixed, depending on the nation. The French looked at the Fubukis and went, oh, that's cute. You built some slightly less small destroyers. Fantastic. Anyway, over back to our torpedo building program. The British and the Americans, though, were a bit more concerned because they had, generally speaking, been in favor of building larger numbers of smaller fleet destroyers in 1,300-1,400 ton region, maybe pushing up to 1,500. Whereas the Fubukis had heavy gun armament and heavy torpedo armament and high speed, and obviously their tonnage was commensurately higher to pay for that. Whereas a lot of the argumentation going back and forth in the Royal and US navies had been, well, we can build a gun destroyer with minimum torpedo armament, we can build a torpedo destroyer with minimal gun armament, or we could build a gun and torpedo destroyer, but it's going to be so slow it's not really worth being called a destroyer anymore. And suddenly the Fubuki show that, well, you just have to make it bigger and more expensive. So everybody scrambled for a bit. They were designing counters, but they decided to legislate their way out of the issue with the London Naval Treaty, which put restrictions on both the absolute size of destroyers and the number of large-ish destroyers that you could have. Of course, the French and the Italians, having already gotten quite heavily into building even bigger destroyers than that, just went, yeah, we're not signing that part of the treaty. Have fun with that. But the three big powers agreed. And so essentially the Royal and US navies went, okay, well, we can build a few big ones, which is, you know, where you get things like the tribal class. But otherwise, we can carry on with the smaller stuff. And the Japanese, who at least by London 1 were trying to comply with the treaties, looked at it and went, okay, well, can we get a Fubuki's worth of armament into a lower displacement as mandated by the treaty for most of our destroyers? And that's how you end up with the Hatsuharas and things rolling over in storms. Hank the Unobtrusive asks, why did the British choose to develop an 18-inch 40-caliber gun when pretty much every main gun in the Dreadnought era had been at least 45 calibers long? And if they'd gone with a 45 caliber instead, how would this have affected the design of Hood and other ships up to the Washington Naval Treaty? Essentially, they were a bit of a rush job, because Fisher had called for 18-inch guns for Furious, but people were a little bit worried that they might not actually work. So instead of going in and designing a full-scale 18-inch 45, which would need its own, obviously, big recoil mounts, etc., and an enlarged turret, they took an existing 15-inch 42 twin turret, modified it slightly to be a single turret mounting, and then looked at it and went, okay, well, if we're going to stick an 18-inch gun in here, what's the biggest and most powerful gun we can reasonably put in this without having to substantially alter the turret? Because the idea was that if the 18-inch gun didn't work out, they could just go straight back to being 15-inch 42 twins like the Courageous and Glorious were. And so they took the schematics for the 15-inch 42 and just scaled it up to 18 inches in diameter, in bore diameter, and went, okay, great. Weight balance to fit this turret. Oh, we have to chop a bit off. Fine. Now we've got an 18-inch 40. And it was only ever intended to arm Furious. So they only ordered three. So one for each end on Furious and then a spare, although obviously only one was ever mounted. And then when they look seriously at putting 18-inch guns on actual full-on battleships, it's always starting from a basis of at least a 45 caliber gun. Essentially, you can view these 18-inch 40s as one-off specials for an otherwise very lightly built ship where it needed its guns in a very great hurry. And as far as the design of Hood, I mean, Hood was being designed quite early in the war, as it turns out, and or at least the basis of its design, so it was always going to have 15-inch guns. But when you look at the immediate post-war designs that eventually will lead up to the G3, they already go up to 18-inch 45 guns pretty darn quickly. They have a brief flirtation with triple turret 15s, and then they just go, no, okay, we're off to the 18-inch Wonder World. And then it turns out they can't actually fit them on the battlecruiser. They do fit them on the N3 battleship, though. Alex Moskowitz asks, I'm surprised at how much cooperation there was between ships of nations like Britain and the US, who had been at war with each other not that long ago when it came to the West Africa Patrol and Squadron. What drove this cooperation? Part of it was, of course, you know, shared language and to a certain degree shared culture. Another part of it was that you've got to remember, especially in the Age of Sail, you see that a little bit as well going into the Age of Iron and Steel, but certainly in the Age of Sail, there was an expectation of an officer and a gentleman, and therefore when you went to war with each other, it wasn't personal. It was a matter of state. And yes, that may require you to shoot at each other, and it may require you to kill each other, but as soon as the shooting was done, everybody was expected to treat each other very civilly. You know, the captured captain would dine, and his first officer, if they survived, would dine with the officers of the ship that had captured them, and so forth. And people who stepped out of line in those regards were very quickly reduced to the state of social pariahs in most cases. So for a lot of captains, if their nations hadn't been at war for a couple of years and they themselves hadn't had any particular reason to bear a personal grudge, well, great. We just get on with life and cooperate. Coupled that with the fact, as I mentioned in a previous dry dock, to go on these kinds of patrols, yes, you could be assigned, but you are still talking about the era where the Admiralty or the Navy Department or whoever offers you a commission to go and do this thing. Of course, those orders might change later on, but especially when it came to the anti-slavery patrols, those were usually the primary task missions. And so if there was a captain who was particularly pro-slavery, he would either manipulate things behind the scenes to make sure he wasn't offered that in the first place, or if his pro-slavery sentiments were known, he just wouldn't be offered that particular commission. Or he could, if he wanted to risk his career a bit, could just say, actually, no, I don't think this is for me. And so you tended to get captains on the anti-slavery patrols who actually wanted to be there. For the most part, they had ideological and moral reasons on top of the fact that they'd just been sent there as part of their orders. And so if you have, let's say, in the late 1810s, early 1820s, a US captain who's out there because he actually really disagrees with slavery and wants to see the trade stamped out, and he meets up with a British captain who is also there in large part because he really dislikes slavery and wants to see the trade stamped out. They have far, far, far more in common than the fact that their two nations may notionally have been shooting at each other a decade earlier. Sharkman asks, what happened to the biased Dutch judge on the Anglo-Dutch Mixed Commission Court? I'm hoping he was drawn and quartered, but I'd settle for him being forcibly removed to a different posting. Oh boy, was this guy an unpopular figure? He goes by either Colonel or Mr. Van Sertema. And yeah, I've got loads of correspondence from Freetown where an awful lot of officials, mostly British, but some others, are just complaining about him and in increasingly strident terms. And the fact that he seems to be there more as the slave trader's patsy than an actual enforcer of the Mixed Commission rules and the Anglo-Dutch Anti-Slavery Treaty, it gets to the point where you have numerous officials, numerous British officials, writing back saying, look, can somebody please get on the line to the Dutch government and get the Dutch government to remind this guy he is there to judge slavers, not help them, essentially. Obviously, they pretty the words up a little bit more than that. But they really, really do not like him. However, in the spirit of, I've never wished a man dead, but I've read many an obituary with great satisfaction, you may or may not be pleased to be informed that he died horribly of a tropical disease, probably malaria, in either late 1820 or early 1821. So he had a fairly short tenure. Jesse Strada asks, who paid the prizes or the prize money for a British ship who took a foreign slaving ship? Did the foreign nation pay out, or did the British government just take a huge continuing loss of money in paying for all the prizes? And if it came out of British government coffers, were they able to recoup any of the losses out of the materials of the ships in question? The initial costs were paid by the Admiralty, and there was quite a detailed breakdown, but very broadly it was broken down into the value of the ship itself, the value of any non-human cargo and other movable fixtures and fittings, spare provisions and stuff that might be on the ship, which could be either utilised or sold off separately, and head money, which was a separate thing, which was paid to the capturing vessel per slave. And as I covered in the video, initially there was a sliding scale fee depending on whether it was a man, woman, child, and who you'd capture them from. And then gradually it got agglomerated into a single rate. So, yeah, that was a fair amount for the Admiralty to pay out. However, once they had paid out that money, they did look to recoup some of those losses. So supplies and such that had been on the ship and had been therefore been purchased, they could be put straight back into the West Africa Squadron. They now belong to the government property. And of course, that meant although the Admiralty had paid somewhat for them, of course, they're paying secondhand rates for supplies that they can now use. And that saves the Admiralty having to pay for those supplies brand new to be sent out to the squadron. So there's a little bit of money overall to be made there by making savings in the stores budget. The head money, there wasn't really much direct ability to recoup that from anybody, but you would sometimes see crews of slave ships fined, and that money would go to the government as well, and that would be for things like actively resisting a Royal Navy boarding attempt. You know, if the Royal Navy shows up, fires a gun, you haul down your sails and pull over, let them inspect you, then that's one thing. If you fight back, yeah, you're going to get slapped with a fine for one of many different things you could throw at them. And then, of course, you've got the ship itself. Now, sometimes the ship would be taken into service as a tender to one of the other ships or put into service with the Sierra Leone government. So again, that was not strictly speaking a loss because they were now getting a use out of it as much as if they purchased any other ship. But other times they felt they didn't need the ship or it was unsuitable. And so then it would be put up for sale. And of course, they would look to get more money than the Admiralty, that is, they would look to get more money for it than they'd paid in prize money based on their strict assessment values. And obviously then if they sold the ship, then they would get the money back and hopefully make a little bit of money on the side as well. Warrant Officer asks, what would be the smallest design change that would have the biggest consequences in getting the US to build an actual battle cruiser during the 1900s and 1910s? I can probably think of two immediate potential very small changes that could then result in the US building a battlecruiser outside of, you know, Congress actually paying the US Navy in this period more than $3 and, you know, a couple of nickels for good measure. One of those would be when they sell Mississippi-class pre-dreadnoughts to Greece. Now, historically, this means that the US Navy goes, yeah, we'll have three New Mexicos this year instead of two. Potentially, with a very slight alteration, they could go, well, we're going to keep our two-ship-per-class system going, and we're then just going to use this money to order a battlecruiser so that we can at least have one and kind of prove the concept. That's potentially one way of going about it. The other thing which potentially could happen would be that, well, you have this historic occurrence, especially in the 1910s, of people constantly overestimating the capabilities of other people's ships because of all the secrecy and the relatively nascent nature of naval spying and intelligence services. So potentially in, you know, 1912-ish, 1913, when they start to get initial reports about the Queen Elizabeth's, that you could potentially see a US Navy officer running in and going, hey, look, the British are building this 15-inch armed super dreadnought, or our intelligence suggests it's definitely going to be bigger than 13.5-inch, because technically they're 13.5-inch specials until almost the last minute. But anyway, they're building this super dreadnought, and they say it's going to be faster than anything they've got at the moment, and if the intel's actually got it right, obviously the British are aiming for 25 knots, and then maybe someone goes, well, you know, let's just spruce this up a little bit, since we know from previous trials that often British ships designed for 21 knots often do 22, so in the report you present to Congress, you say, well, look, this ship is going to be able to do 26 knots, and crucially, of course, that means this ship is now as fast as an early battlecruiser, only it's going to be heavily armoured and it's going to have lots of big heavy guns, and this is a potential disaster because they're primarily planning on building a ton of them, and if they do that, we're stuffed because, well, they've got more armour, more firepower and higher speed. Can we please at least have something that's fast enough to keep up with them, even if you're not going to let us build a super ship of our own? And maybe pitch it to Congress as, well, you can either let us build a 26-knot 14 or 16 inch armed battleship, fast battleship. Congress will take one look at that bill and go, no. And they go, okay, fine. Well, we don't have to build it with quite as much armor, and maybe we don't have to build it with quite as many guns. But we do need the speed, but that will make it a lot cheaper. So how about we build that instead? And Congress says, yeah, okay, that is a cheaper option. And then battlecruiser. Jason W. Key asks, what do you think a 35,000-ton treaty-compliant battlecruiser would look like? And what difference would it be if it was British, American, or Japanese? Well, we know what a British one would look like because they actually designed one. That would be, well, the F2 and F3 series. So this is a rough approximation of F3 done in Ultimate Admiral Dreadnoughts. So all forward armament, three triple turrets with 15-inch guns. Wouldn't be 15-inch 42s, be new 15-inch either 45 or 15-inch 50s. But there you go. That is a 35,000-ton treaty-compliant battlecruiser designed specifically to comply with the Washington Naval Treaty. Now, as for national flavour differences, I think if you were looking at a Japanese vessel, it would probably have four twin turrets, probably two forward and two aft, and perhaps trade out a little bit of armour for speed. And the American version would probably have very little armor, possibly have either two forward triples and one triple aft, or four twins, almost certainly with 16-inch guns. Maybe a twin superfiring over triple like the Nevadas with 14-inch guns for 10 guns. But especially if it's the early 20s, probably the twin 16s. And yeah, it's a very little armor, slightly higher speed, and fairly long range. BK Zhong asks, Japan's lack of fire control radar is well established, but why is the idea that Japan lacked fire control systems in this period so prevalent, even amongst certain historians? I think, unfortunately, you sometimes get conflation with people thinking, okay, well, in World War II, radar-directed fire control is the modern thing. And to be honest, I think people forget that actually, even in World War II, that's not necessarily the case, especially in the early part of the war. You know, in the early part of the war, a lot of ships do not have radar. Even British, American, and some German ships just flat out don't have radar at the beginning. Many of them do, but others don't. And as they gradually acquire radar, initially a lot of that radar is first air search and then surface search. And then people discover that some of the surface search radar is actually high enough resolution. It provides decent ranging figures. And then you get into radar directed gunnery control. But as a result of, you know, pretty much any ship worth the name in the US and British navies by the end of the war, and what's left of the Kriegsmarine, but yeah, having radar-directed fire control by the end of the war, everyone goes, oh, yes, well, that is the modern thing. And so people look at the Italians and the Japanese, who don't have gunnery radar by the end of their respective portions of the war, and they go, oh, well, clearly they didn't have modern fire control, because they view radar as a critical aspect of modern fire control. And in fact, that's not actually strictly true, because radar is an input to fire control, but the actual fire control system is your fire control computer. It's taking in data and it's spitting out fire control solutions for you. And in that respect, the Italians and the Japanese both had excellent optically guided fire control systems and excellent optics. And if you wanted them to have radar gunnery fire control, you literally just plug the radar range and bearing data in instead of the ones from the optical systems. And towards the end of the war, Yamato, for example, did have a number of radars, and at least one of the radars that she carried, although it wasn't a gunnery control radar, it was a surface search radar, was kind of approaching the early war Allied radars in terms of it was able to give some range data, which the Japanese could use to either check the optical data or, in theory at least, blind fire when they couldn't see because of smoke or rain or cloud or darkness or whatever. So they were getting towards that capability, but they obviously, by that point, the Americans and the British have fully independent radar gunnery systems. But in any case, I think what happens is people then sometimes conflate, oh, okay, well, the Japanese radar gunnery is behind the Allies, therefore they don't have modern fire control systems. And then somewhere along the line, modern gets dropped off. And then you get, oh, the Japanese didn't have proper fire control systems. And you're like, what? The Japanese had proper optical fire control systems in World War One. They even had a certain degree of optical fire control systems in the Russo-Japanese War. What are you saying? They did have fire control systems. Of course they did. It's just the inputs are different. And yeah, it's kind of the ever-circling game of reduction that people sometimes play, trying to overly simplify things. And then you end up by oversimplifying too much. You end up actually coming up with stuff that is completely flat out wrong. NCO Gets It asks, looking at the data of the naval arms race and its ships, guns and shells in the run-up to and during World War One, it's pretty clear the Royal Navy had more firepower, but at what cost versus what effectiveness? How much did each of the three navies spend? What was spent compared to their GDP? Did they overspend, underspend, get it right? I mean, it appears at casual glance the Royal Navy must have outspent everyone in raw terms, but did this also represent something approaching equity in GDP terms? It might be easy to say the Germans overspent and the Royal Navy may have overspent and the US Navy underspent, considering it from that perspective. So in terms of efficiency, cost per ship, the British actually have quite an edge over everyone else, partly just because they're ordering them in such large numbers they get economies of scale, and partly because their shipyards are a lot more experienced and they have a bigger industry to draw on. So, for example, if you look at, roughly speaking, the 1912 period, the British are building the Iron Duke-class super dreadnoughts with 13.5-inch guns. They're paying just a fraction under £2 million for them. At about the same time, the Germans are building the Koenig class, which only have 12-inch guns, but they cost about 45 million marks, which is equivalent at the time at those exchange rates to about 2.25 million. So it's costing them about £250,000 to £300,000 more to build a 12-inch armed dreadnought than compared to the British building, a 13.5-inch super dreadnought. And a contemporary Nevada-class battleship was costing the US around about the, either the same as a Koenig or anything up to £2.5 million equivalent, because the thing is with the Nevadas, their cost is given minus armament and armor, which are fairly important parts of a ship. So essentially the hull and machinery price is about $6 million, and it's between $5 and $6 million for the armament and the armor. So you're looking at $11 to $12 million. So you're looking at the US either costing about the same as the Germans or slightly more. So the Royal Navy is definitely getting a lot more bang for its buck. But of course, they are also building a lot more, so they are outspending everyone. And as for percentage of GDP, again, if we use roughly 1912 as a benchmark, obviously naval budgets and GDP vary quite considerably over this period, but 1912 is nice and kind of in the middle of it all. The US is spending about 0.4% of GDP on its navy. The Germans are spending about 0.8% of GDP on their navy. And then with the British, it gets a little bit more difficult, because if you go purely by the UK's GDP, as in the United Kingdom, they're spending about 2% of GDP on the navy, which is obviously considerably more than, considerably more than Germany and America combined. But of course, you have things like Malaya, New Zealand, Australia, which are being paid for overseas, and the fact, well, Britain does have an empire. And the GDP figures that are used for the US include all the various bits of the world that the US had taken over from Spain, and it was also German Empire GDP. So if we use British Empire GDP, it works out at about 0.8%, so roughly equivalent in terms of proportional GDP to what the Germans are spending. As I said, this is assuming you rope empires in on all sides. You suppose you could try and filter out GDP from Germany, the continental United States, and the UK. I mean, we know the UK one, but filter out the other two, and you'll get slightly different figures, but it is an interesting point of comparison. Anson Ellis asks, could coal-powered ships use wood or sawdust as a cheaper fuel, and did it happen? Theoretically, you could, because at the end of the day, with coal-powered boilers, you shovel things into the furnace, things burn, things create heat, and off you go. However, the energy density of wood is considerably less than that of coal. So if you shovel in a similar volume of coal and a similar volume of wood, the wood is going to give you a lot less heat, therefore you're not going to get as much power, therefore you're going to have to shovel a whole bunch more wood and hope that it burns fairly quickly, because otherwise you're just going to end up building up a massive bank of semi-burnt material, which is going to choke everything down. Another issue is, because of that, if you wanted to go a similar distance, you'd have to carry vastly more wood. And if you tried to use sawdust, well, that's inviting fuel air explosion, so don't do that. Also, sawdust and wood, especially stored in bunkers on ships, is likely to get quite damp, which is going to cause all end of problems when you're trying to use it in a fire. Now, that's not to say that wood is completely out of the question for use in boilers. It is out of the question as a main fuel source, but it is still, as I said, a fuel source. So there are cases of otherwise ostensibly coal-powered ships using wood for fuel, but what it tends to be is either, one, when they desperately need to bring boilers online ASAP, wood fires are much easier to set and will ignite and burn faster than it is, you know, compared to a coal fire. So if you pile a bunch of kindling and a few big blocks of wood into the middle of your boiler and set it alight, you'll have a decent fire going pretty darn quickly, around which you can stack coals, and then the coals will catch and then everything else catches, as opposed to just piling a bunch of coal in the middle and trying to set fire to that. I mean, pretty much the same thing you kind of have with a charcoal barbecue. You usually need some kind of accelerant, and very often people use wood as kindling. The other thing is, of course, if you're running out of coal for whatever reason, some fuel's better than no fuel. So especially early on, with some of the early steam-powered ships' attempts to cross the Atlantic, towards the end, if they'd miscalculated the amount of coal they needed or they'd run into adverse conditions, they would start stripping down and burning wooden bits of the ship just to keep the boilers going so the ship could keep going forwards. And likewise, although it has a lower energy density because it does flare up pretty quickly, sometimes you would find in emergency situations people would use bits of wood to accelerate the immediate heat produced by a boiler to generate a quick burst of additional steam to give you more power, but they would also be shoveling in coal to sustain that. GV82 asks, were any tactics developed specifically to deal with all forward gun ships? Not particularly, and for two primary reasons. The first being that, unless you're looking at the late 1930s French fast capital ship fleet, which was never really completed, the presence of any all forward gun ships, whether they be the Nelsons, the Dunkirks, the Tournays, etc., was always going to be in the context of a much larger force of more conventionally laid out vessels. And as such, you would tailor your tactics to deal with those because while these ships might have all forward guns, they were going to be, especially with battleships, fitting in the battle line and conforming to the movements and tactics of the other vessels. So the tactics you'd use to deal with, the other seven or eight battleships that are around, in theory, if you're fighting a big fleet battle, would also apply to, say, tackling the Nelsons. The other thing, of course, is that there aren't actually that many tactics that you can use in a straight-up gunfight with an all-forward ship that would really work specifically for that kind of vessel. Now, I'm sure a lot of people are going, but just go behind it because it doesn't have guns there. Well, yes, but one, a lot of these all-forward ships had specific design considerations put into them to allow them quite considerable rear arcs of fire. So it's not just a case of being, slightly aft of their amidships. You would have to be right up in the, back 30, 40 degrees, maybe, depending on the ship. But even then, because of the ranges that you're going to end up fighting at, if you are, let's say, roughly broadside to something like HMS Nelson, and maybe you're even lucky enough to have a fast ship, like, say, a Congo, rather than a slower vessel. And let's say we're going to be even more generous and you're going on an opposing course and you're at relatively close range, shall we say 20,000 yards, mid-battle range for a ship in the 30s. So to make your way all the way around, assuming that the Nelson class stays on its course and doesn't change its speed or direction at all, for you to sail in an arc at 20,000 yards around to the point that you'd get into the Nelson class's blind spot, you would have to sail a distance of about 36 nautical miles, which means that even at top speed in a modernized Congo, you would have to sail for over an hour just to get in the blind spot. You'd be saying about 73,000 yards. And of course, during all that time, the Nelson class is going to be shooting at you. And to be perfectly honest, if you're in a gunfight one-on-one in battleships and the decision hasn't been made within the first hour, something has probably gone horribly wrong one way or the other. And of course, at any point during your massive hour-plus sailing to try and get into the aft arc of the ship, the captain of the Nelson class can just go, okay, well, I'm going to spend a couple of minutes turning and essentially reset your problem back to square one. So at that point, you just have to kind of accept you're going to be in the gun arcs and deal with it. Captain Oblivious asks, here's a fun one for you. I met a guy who was building one of those incredibly expensive, think $1,200 plus wooden ship kits. This one was of HMS Victory at Trafalgar. He said he was 7 years into it and had about a year to go. Have you ever thought of building a model kit like this? Either way, which would you pick to build if you did? The guy I spoke to said it's not necessarily building the ship that's the hard part, it's the extremely detailed painting and rigging, as you need to be an expert with an airbrush and extremely dexterous and steady to do all the rigging. I've thought about it at various points, but ultimately, I've come to the conclusion that even when I had many fewer obligations in life, I just, A, didn't have the time to devote to something like that, and B, I didn't have the space to store the finished result, certainly anywhere where it wouldn't end up being smashed and broken by accident in a very, very short period of time. So that kind of mitigated against it. And also, much as I do love model kits, and naval model kits, 40k Battlefleet Gothic, various spacecraft, old naval ships, all sorts of stuff. You know, I am a bit of an invertebrate model collector, but I also know that when it comes to extremely complex kits, apart from time and cost and display space, I just don't have the patience to come back to that model week after week, month after month, year after year, and make tiny bits of incremental progress when there are so many other interesting things to do. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that's a bad thing to have as a hobby. I absolutely admire the people who can build large-scale, high-precision model kits in extreme levels of detail, but it's just not for me. If it comes to extremely large, high-precision detail kits, I'm personally tend to be the kind of person who would either go, okay, has somebody made a large but relatively speaking simple kit, like a 1-200 trumpeter or something like that, or can I make it myself? So, you know, can I nowadays, especially, can I create a 3D file, and you know, I'll put a lot of work into the 3D file and then 3D print the thing, but then the printer's doing the most of the construction work, and then I have to put the bits together and paint it up. But that's still a much, much simpler task than the kind of, you know, wooden ship kits that people tend to like. I do have one of HMS Speedy, which at some point I will sit down and make, but it's staying in its box basically until I know where exactly I'm going to display it afterwards, again, without it obviously ending up broken and smashed to the four winds. If I was going to do one of those extremely large-scale, stupidly detailed kits, I'd probably pick something like a late-era ironclad, like an 1880s ironclad of some description, purely because they're really unique, really odd, and there aren't a huge number of those kind of large-scale models of that era of ship around. HMS Islay 10101 asks, what does damage when a shell impacts? Is it inertia or kinetic energy? Kinetic energy being half mass times velocity squared suggests that most damage comes from the impact speed, so a lighter shell is faster at the moment of impact, whereas momentum suggests a balance between mass and velocity. I'm aware of in-flight ballistics, which means that the heavier projectile sheds velocity slower, and kinetic energy is more about impact velocity. In a very crude approximation, kinetic energy is the thing that does the damage. The inertia or momentum is what allows the damage to continue. Now, that is a very, very crude approximation, so don't come jumping down my throat, but it roughly holds true as kind of a first-order estimate. So the kinetic energy, half mass times velocity squared, that is actually the, you know, the amount of energy that the shell has as it's moving, which could then be turned into some kind of work or some other form of energy in terms of, you know, breaking the armor, retaining velocity through the armor, and also partially destroying the shell. And so, yes, the lighter shell goes faster at impact because it has a higher muzzle velocity. But as you said, you know, the momentum or inertia of a heavier shell, because it loses velocity slower, it's not that the heavier shell is inherently better at armor penetration. It's that it retains more of its energy at the expected battle ranges. So if you were to take, let's say, a average weight 16-inch shell, or even a slightly lightweight 16-inch shell, and fire it out of a 16-inch 50 caliber gun as found on an Iowa class, and you were to fire that at a target that was, let's say, 5,000 yards away, and you were to fire at that same target with a super heavy 16-inch shell at 5,000 yards. Now, in those cases, if we imagine our target is, let's say, a football stadium-sized lump of ballistic gel, once you analyze where the shell has ended up on its flight path through the massive block of gel, you will find that the lighter weight 16-inch shell will have gone considerably further because it had slightly less mass, but considerably more velocity. Therefore, it had more kinetic energy. Therefore, it did damage as it passed its way through for longer before it ran out of energy. But if you went out to 20,000, 25,000, 30,000 yards, you'd find that now the lighter shell is going less distance than the heavy shell once it hits our hypothetical massive ballistic gel block. And that's, as I say, it's not because there's something inherent to the shaping and sizing of the heavier shell, assuming that they both have otherwise the similar dimensions. It's simply that because of air resistance, as the shells have gone on, the lighter shell has lost more and more velocity, and it's lost considerably more velocity than the heavy shell, which means when it arrives, it's going to have lower velocity and lower mass, therefore considerably less kinetic energy, than the heavier shell, which has retained more of its velocity, therefore has now become the faster shell. And the additional mass obviously, you know, factors into the equation as well, but not as much as the velocity, which is squared. And then you have inertia. And so inertia is quite important, obviously, because you can have things that have an awful lot of kinetic energy. But if they don't have a huge amount of inertia behind them, because maybe they don't mass very much, but they're going very fast, it's very easy for them to bounce, reflect, or shatter, or in some other way expend a lot of that energy in a way that isn't to do with actually penetrating through the target. So you do need inertia to, as I said, continue to do damage. Once that initial kinetic energy has been delivered and the armor starts to break open, the inertia, again, in very crude terms, is what helps continue pushing the shell in the direction it was going, as opposed to just, you know, bouncing away. Alternate historian Turtle Duck asks, you've mentioned in passing that the Germans moving Scharnhorst and Gneisenau out to Norway, or their intention to do so, was a mistake on the part of the Germans. Could you expand on that? And if the Channel Dash had never happened, how long would Scharnhorst and Gneisenau have realistically lasted? So the reason I think the Channel Dash as a general concept was something of a mistake is because when you look at the even ideal before and after outcomes, you know, ignoring the fact that both Scharnhorst and Gneisenau managed to hit a bunch of mines, which meant that was pretty much the end of the career for Gneisenau, as it turned out. If you move the ships to Germany, what exactly do you accomplish? You can deploy them to Norway. Okay, great. But when you deploy them to Norway, their primary threat is against the Arctic convoys. The Arctic convoys are relatively close, relatively predictable courses, relatively near to the home fleet. Therefore, the home fleet, especially once the Americans are helping out, can provide pretty heavy cover, and they have there's only a few places in Norway that you can position the ships to threaten the Arctic convoys, which means it's, relatively speaking, easy to monitor them. And so it becomes a bit more of a known quantity to counter. And it's much easier to bring those forces to bear to counter. Plus, if you're docked up right in the north of Norway, it means that for the prodigious amounts of fuel these ships are going to need, the Germans are going to have to find the fuel. And obviously Germany was not exactly, you know, flush with fuel oil in the middle to late part of World War II. But once they've got that, they've also got to take the fairly extreme risks of shipping it all the way up there. And of course, those tankers can be attacked from the air, attacked from submarines, and of course you have to operate the ships themselves, the tankers, which has a cost because they could be doing other things. And of course you need all the infrastructure, ideally in Norway, to store this oil, unless you want to store the tankers to refuel the ships. And so you have a relatively difficult logistics chain, a relatively limited amount of enemy targets that you can actually go for, and overall, your strategic impact is relatively speaking, smaller, because, as I said, the enemy can bring a known quantity of forces there ready to counter you from a relatively short distance away. And even if you manage to magically break out from Norway without necessarily being detected immediately, and you manage to get after an Arctic convoy or two, at absolute best, you can get an Arctic convoy or two. And yeah, okay, the Russians aren't going to like that, the Allies aren't going to like that, but the overall impact on the supply of materials to the Russians or the Soviets is going to be limited. And in theory, you could try and pull a Bismarck and, you know, be in Norway, then make a break for the Atlantic. But you then either have to pass dangerously close to Scotland or you have to go between Greenland and Iceland. And in nautical terms, those are something of choke points. And you, again, can get hunted down and destroyed. Conversely, if you are on the west coast of France, even when you're further on the northern end of that coast, so where Charles de Gaulle now historically were, at the very least, you're distracting a huge amount of British effort in the repeated bombing raids they're sending after you to try and cripple you. But there are other ports that the Germans have occupied all the way down the western coast of France. And indeed, occasionally, one or the other Scharnhorst was moved down there specifically to get it out of Allied bomber range. So if the Scharnhorst could be made broadly operational and then sent further south, where they'd be out of all but the most ambitious of bombing raids, then they're going to be in a pre-existing French naval port. So it's going to have a whole bunch of repair and support infrastructure, fuel tanks, etc. Getting the fuel from your existing fuel sources means shipping it across a continent, probably on trains or something like that. But the infrastructure to move fuel around within continental Europe is much, much more available than the infrastructure of moving large amounts of fuel by tanker up the Norwegian coast through a relatively hostile North Sea. So although your overall amount of fuel produced isn't going to be affected by this, the ability to actually get fuel to the ships is going to be much improved. And of course, because you can launch straight out into the Atlantic, the Allies don't have the capability to put a huge blockade all the way up the French Atlantic coast to stop something like a pair of Scharnhorsts. And as soon as you get out into the Atlantic, you're not a threat to one or two Arctic convoys, you're a threat to upwards of possibly a dozen convoys, because you're going to have convoys going across the Atlantic east to west, convoys going west to east, convoys coming up from Gibraltar, convoys going back down to Gibraltar, convoys coming from South America, convoys coming from the Caribbean, and if you head out obviously to the Western Atlantic, there's convoys going up the US coast. There's so many more convoys in the Atlantic at any one time, and if you have a couple of battleships scootling around, then either you have to, as the Allies, have to put massive numbers of heavy escorts all across the Atlantic to try and guard everywhere or near enough everywhere at once, or you have to put in a massive hunt, or possibly both, and even then you might not get it all correct, because the Scharnhorst might then show up in some way that you didn't anticipate. And once they're out, the disruption effect, even if they don't actually sink anything, the disruption effect on all of those convoys is going to be massively, massively greater, both in just sheer numerical amounts and in proportional impact on the Allied war effort, than even the complete and utter destruction of a single Arctic convoy was ever going to be. So, yeah, that's basically why I think the Channel Dash was a bit of a mistake. Now, granted, the Scharnhorst weren't going to be able to sit around in Brest indefinitely. The Allies had come very close to badly damaging or sinking them several times while they were there, but there were other ports available. As for how long they would realistically last, if they were, say, in Bordeaux or something like this, I think a lot of it comes down to sheer blind luck, because if they, you know, you could have a situation where they repair themselves, they fuel themselves up, they head out in late 42 or early 43 for another, like, Operation Berlin Mark II. If they get unlucky, they could be cornered and sunk like Bismarck was by superior Allied forces, but they might get away with it. And then 6 months later, they could try again. And again, they might get cornered and sunk. They might get away with it. Every time they roll the dice, there is a higher and higher chance of them being cornered and sunk, simply because there's more and more and more Allied naval assets in the area. But I think the Germans will get an awful lot more use out of them than they historically got out of the two ships once they completed the Channel Dash. Cheddar Bacon asks, the Washington Naval Treaty's capital ship tonnage and armament limits prevented most of the 14 and 16-inch armed capital ships from quickly becoming outright obsolete in the face of what would have been the ships of the early 1920s. But those same vessels still ended up being second, third, or even fourth rate compared with the first rate ships of the treaty era of the late 1930s. Could the treaty limits have been any higher and not rendered all but perhaps the Queen Elizabeth's, Nagatos, Colorados, and battle cruisers obsolete? Honestly, I don't really think so, because if you look at what made the treaty era battleships, i.e., the King George V, North Carolinas, etc., able to do more with 35,000 tons, despite the need for things like anti-aircraft armament and so forth, compared to the Nagatos, Nelsons, Colorados, it was in large part the advance of naval technology, particularly propulsion technology, that gave them speed. Now, if you look at the treaty restrictions of the Washington Naval Treaty, so you've got the 16-inch upper limit on guns, and you've got the 35,000 limit on tonnage. You're free to make them as fast or as slow or as heavily armored or as lightly armored as you like. So what can we do by playing with those? Well, if you increase the gun armament size to its next logical increment, let's say 18 inches, you're going to face a big problem, because none of the ships designed in the 1910s were ever designed to stand up to 18-inch shells. So if you have that, and then you have like the Nelsons, let's say, built with 18-inch guns somehow, and the treaty era ships are perhaps armed with 6 18-inch guns or something silly like that, the simple fact is those guns, especially 45 or 50 caliber 18-inch guns in the late 30s, they're going to have such a ridiculous range advantage and a such a massive penetration advantage over everything else that's come before them, that even something like the Queen Elizabeth's, Nagatos, and Colorados aren't really going to stand much of a chance, especially because if you're faced with the prospect of having only 6 guns on something, maybe in 3 twin turrets, that's when people are going to get really inventive and creative with weight saving measures. So perhaps a lot more all forward ships, just to scrape out those few extra tons so you can have 8 or 10 or 9 guns instead of 6. So you can't really do all that much upping the scale of the armament, and I don't think you can really do all that much upping the scale of the displacement either, because Hood is in the low 40,000s of tons, and Hood proves that even a few years before the treaty limits, you can get a fast capital ship on a little bit over 40,000 tons. Now, if you were to, say, do the treaty displacement limit at 40,000 tons, you could quite conceivably get, instead of Hood, which is well north of 30 knots, you could quite conceivably get essentially a something that would be recognizable in the 30s as a fast battleship. So decent protection, 27, 28 knot speed, maybe around about that, and a good amount of firepower, 15 or 16 inch guns. You could do that on 40,000 tons in the early 1920s, which essentially brings the fast battleship concept forward by almost 2 decades in terms of widespread acceptance and implementation. Now, of course, as time goes on during the interval period, you would have to incorporate the rise of anti-aircraft weaponry in a big way into those ships. But when it comes to then designing your new treaty ships in the mid to late 30s, if you've got 40,000 tons baseline to play with and you're still restricted to 16-inch guns, you're going to get a good anti-aircraft suite, really good armor, 9, possibly 12 16-inch guns in on there, and still fast battleship speed. So you're going to end up with the same kind of speed advantage that you had over the 1910s era ships historically, only with more guns, more armor, and a considerably better all-rounded ship. And those would be, I mean, obviously still, a QE, a Colorado, a Nelson would, or something like that, or a Nagato could still hurt those ships, but it would be an awful lot more difficult for them, and the margins would be stacked much more against them. Brendan Buersdorf asks, I was looking at some never-built ship designs on Shipbucket, and I came across something called a seaplane raider. It came in 2 sizes and seemed to be a ship for raiding convoys with float planes, and was otherwise relatively minimally armed. Is this a real design the Germans came up with, and is there any existing plan for it? I'm curious if you could shed some light on the two versions and their specifications and how useful the ship could actually be. Honestly, I don't know. Shipbucket's rules prevent me from posting the pictures here, but have another German seaplane tender thing instead. Yeah, honestly, I really, really don't know if they are actually valid designs from the Kriegsmarine in World War II. I've not seen them before. I've not come across them before. I looked through my reference books. I couldn't find any real references that would seem to match up to them. And honestly, I don't think they'd be particularly useful, because just looking at the designs of them as shown on Shipbucket, they've essentially got a minimal anti-aircraft armament, and that's about it. So even a destroyer significantly outguns them, because it's going to have better fire control and probably larger guns, etc. The vessel also doesn't look particularly fast, so it's going to have trouble with any kind of roving escort like cruisers, and or even armed merchant cruisers for that matter, hunting it down. And honestly, seaplanes by World War II are pretty poor for raiding. You know, they're slower, they can't carry as much of a payload. They're okay, admittedly, catapulting off means they're easier to fly off, but then they've got to land on the sea and be picked up, which means you have to slow down. So it's much more awkward to operate, and they've got less striking power compared to even a small aircraft carrier. I mean, when I'm just looking at that, the design on Shipbucket, I would have just said, well, you know, if that's the hull you're stuck with, just raise the top and make it a very small aircraft carrier. You'll get more utility out of it. Or, heck, upscale this thing. You know, it's a seaplane tender, but if you know, doubled the size of the thing, you could probably use it as a very small, fast raiding carrier. Even with only half a dozen bombers or something, it would still be more effective than a pretty, you know, not particularly swift seaplane carrier in raiding. Texas and La Shock asks, what is the general process of learning to helm a ship? Now, I can only answer this in relatively vague terms because, of course, the process of learning to helm a ship varies quite considerably over the time period that a channel covers. And, of course, you know, there are going to be people who either have learned to helm a ship or have seen other people learn to helm a ship who can give you an answer in much more detail. But to summarize briefly from, say, a perspective of the late 19th, early 20th centuries, for the Navy at least, your initial course teaching, if you like, in helming a ship starts very, very small. So it'll be with boats at whatever your naval academy is. Could be Annapolis for the US, Dartmouth for the UK, etc. You'll be taking small boats out in the harbours and learning how to handle them. Then your naval academy might have slightly larger vessels, launches, maybe even the odd small ship around, again, depending on the period. Once you've been semi-competently trained in how to direct something as small as a launch or a ship's boat, you will then move up to these essentially very small ships, and you'll learn how to helm those. And a lot of it's going to come down to learning how quickly a ship responds, because of course you put the rudder over, ships don't turn immediately. And, you know, how much distance do you have to leave? How does the turning radius and the distance you have to leave vary depending on speed? How does the length to breadth ratio of the ship and the setup of the rudder affect things? How much sharper do you turn with the rudder at 30 degrees compared to 20 degrees compared to 10 degrees? And obviously all of this would be under the instruction of navigating qualified officers. And then there's no real way of then having an intermediary step, because then once you're in the Navy, the ship is the ship. Now, you might receive a little bit of further instruction on the ship's launches and boats if there's the time and the availability. But if you're then going to learn navigation, and obviously this is outside of classroom learning for navigation and so forth, but if you're talking purely about the practical lessons, then you might be held under instruction on the bridge while the ship is out in the middle of the ocean, and there's no chance of you hitting anything, and you might take some further instruction on the bridge there, learning how to handle the particular ship you're on, getting a bit of a feel for it. And I mean, at that point you should have a lot of other time at the helm of smaller vessels under your control. And then as you become qualified, obviously you can move up and around and become more specialized. But that's generally how it seems to be from the sources I've read. But as I say, that's, you know, leaving out a huge amount of classroom instruction and theory, which you'd be using to inform your actions on the sea. Natha Bronhong Sharon asks, I just realised, at least according to drawings I can find online, the British Cat series battle cruisers had 9-inch armour only over the machinery, not the fore and aft magazines. These were protected by 5 to 6 inches. Was Queen Mary just hit there, and the quite powerful 12-inch shell then just punched straight through it? I can see why you might come to that conclusion. However, the fore and aft magazine protection of the Splendid Cats is a bit of a weird one that does need a little bit more explanation. So yes, right fore and right aft, the magazines of the Splendid Cats did have thinner protection than the 9-inch belt amidships. However, if you are trying to trace a path of a shell going through the belt into the main magazines, there's actually substantially more protection than just a, say, a 5-inch plate or a 6-inch plate, depending exactly where you are. Whereas if you're going for the machinery, yeah, you get through the 9-inch plate, then you're basically, there's a chance you might get just under the deck armor if you drop a little bit short. Otherwise, it'll just be hit the deck and then through, and the deck's not that thick. There's some coal bunkers there as well. But when you're looking at the magazines, they have this really interesting system of protection where you've got the outer belt. So yes, that is not the thickest. It's not going to stop a 12-inch shell, but it is definitely going to initiate a 12-inch shell. But when you look at where the magazines are placed, and as I trace the path, then, because this is World War I, so everybody has turtle back armor schemes, your 12-inch shell, having punched through the side plating, whether it be 5 or 6 inches, and initiated its fuse, then will hit the turtleback sloped armor of the deck. Now, admittedly, that armor's almost certainly not going to stop the 12-inch shell, but it might deflect its angle, and it's going to further slow it down. And then, once the shell's gotten through that, there's another usually 2.5 inches of armor, essentially in a box, if you like, surrounding the magazines themselves, a bit like what would later be implemented in some other warships. And by the point the shell reaches deep enough into the ship to be heading for the magazines, having gone through the outer armor and then gone through the deck armor, it should at this point be broken up or in the middle of detonating, at which point it becomes a matter of, can that 2.5-inch plate stop the blast and remaining fragments from penetrating the magazines? And obviously the British designers thought that was probably viable. The 12-inch German shell could probably quite easily punch through the belt at the fore and aft end of a Splendid Cat type battlecruiser's protection, but how much further it's going to get after that and potentially directly reach the magazines, that's a lot more marginal, because remember, we are still talking about World War One era 12-inch shells. So at the kind of ranges that Queen Mary is fighting, I'd hazard more that the armour would have done its job in that kind of circumstance than not, because of course the magazines can be considerably deeper down in the ship, and therefore you require a higher angle of fall compared to the machinery, which, being quite tall, has to come up quite close to the waterline. And that's all for this week, everybody. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope to see you again in another video soon. Bye for now.